to my first visit to UQ. And usually I speak in Melbourne at RMIT. Last time I spoke there, a couple of months ago, there were 370 students at one midday gathering and 200 at another midday gathering. Whether it's a large group or a small group, it's all right with me. I welcome the opportunity to share and to hear from you all. What I am trying to alert people to is that our whole system of knowledge, as we know it, is undergoing a rapid change. So many things that we were sure about in terms of human knowledge are now becoming more and more suspect. And it's becoming more and more obvious that there's so much more to existence and to the cosmos than what our traditional paradigms allow for. What I try to do is highlight various areas which show that mystery is alive and well even in Western civilization. First of all, I begin with the mystery of consciousness. As most of you may know, there is not one scientific device in the world which can detect the presence of consciousness. The only reason why we know there is consciousness is because each person feels, I am conscious, so the other people must be conscious. Otherwise, there's no scientific apparatus for directly detecting the presence of consciousness. More and more, consciousness is being recognized as the last frontier. As you may know, if we don't understand consciousness, how can we really be said to understand what comes to us by virtue of consciousness? In other words, we are attempting to know something by the grace of something that is unknown. Now, what does this have to do with the ancient knowledge of India? Our present-day knowledge is matter-based. Our science is concerned with matter and its measurements, the quantification of matter. Whereas the knowledge of ancient India is predominantly consciousness-based, and you can't quantify consciousness. What you can do about consciousness is to qualify it. You can deal with different qualities of consciousness. So in this way, we're dealing with two different types of civilization. And because these two types of civilization differ so much, it has been very, very difficult for scholars of India to truly understand India's past. Because they're always looking into the past, into remote antiquity, for things that resemble the matter-based knowledge and matter-based culture that we've had for the past 2,000 or so years, roughly. When you read the ancient spiritual texts of India, such as Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, you read accounts of an advanced civilization which fully tapped the powers of consciousness. Now, of course, according to the current historical presentations, there was no civilization as we know it in India until at best 3,000 years ago. if you take the version of Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, you find out that there was a thriving civilization in India 5,000 years ago and even deeper into the past. Now, obviously, most mainstream scholars would turn up their nose at any kind of statement that intelligent life has been on this planet for millions of years. But these are the kind of statements that the Vedic knowledge of India makes, quite frankly. I don't know if many of you are aware of it, but there is quite a commotion in the study of human antiquity. There is evidence being brought out to the open that the human species has been around for many, many millions of years before the date we are conventionally handed. The public is more and more becoming aware of these things. This is not a shock for anyone who takes seriously the ancient knowledge of India. The ancient knowledge of India differs from our Western knowledge in some fundamental way. So let's deal with that before we discuss further about the missing glories of India's remote past. What are the ways that are different? Well, first of all, we already discussed how the ancient Vedic knowledge of India is consciousness-based as opposed to matter-based. Number two, that body of knowledge teaches that intelligent human beings have been on this planet from the very beginning, whatever that beginning is. In other words, intelligent human beings are not a recent development. Moreover, the ancient knowledge of India teaches that intelligent life is everywhere in the universe, although it may not take the forms that we are accustomed to seeing on the planet Earth. Some of these things seem very outlandish to those who are deeply attached to the conventional paradigms of knowledge. But you'll find that more and more is happening in reputed circles about extraordinary things that are going to force us to reshape our whole approach to knowledge, our whole understanding of knowledge. Often the question arises, if India had such an extraordinary civilization in remote antiquity, where are the signs now? That is a good question. Archaeologists have not found any sufficient evidence. All you have is the ancient Vedic texts, which describe in great detail the accomplishments and explorations of this consciousness-based culture of India's remote antiquity. But something has to give. Now, just because archaeologists can't find something doesn't mean such a civilization never existed. Some of you may know that just in the past 2 years, it has been verified in Central Asia the existence of a completely new civilization that is said to have existed 4,000 years ago. It appeared out of nowhere in the area of Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan. Completely new civilization. Out of nowhere. No one expected it to be there. A civilization advanced enough that it had apartment complexes the size of a football field. And a writing system, or near-writing system, quasi-writing system. Scholars are bickering whether it is a near-writing system or a approaching a writing system. But the fact is, now, such a civilization is recognized as being at least 4,000 years old, and having had something near or indeed truly a writing system. But we see new civilizations out in the middle of nowhere in Central Asia, showing no, how should we say, showing its own development, not that simply it seems to be an offshoot of Egypt or Mesopotamia or India, its own thing, existing in an area where no one expected such to be. But there's an example. Scholars who are very forthright say this is rewriting our whole understanding of ancient history. But you look in the skies and you find astronomers finding not only new planets, but they're finding things they can't even classify as planets. They don't know what to call them. Then you have scientists studying near-death experiences, particularly at Caltech. And they're saying, we can't confirm it, but we can't deny it. Near-death experiences seem quite factual, and they may be indicating that although all the organs of the body are shut down, the brain's not functioning, consciousness is still functioning. Just a few of the things that are happening that are shaking our traditional foundations of knowledge. If you study the ancient Vedic knowledge of India, you'll be well equipped to deal with these challenges. You'll be well equipped to understand that the self is different from the body. You'll be well equipped to understand life on other planets. You'll be well equipped to understand how intelligent human beings can have existed on this planet far earlier than the current story allows. There are archaeologists who want to present evidence, not theory, they want to present evidence of intelligent human beings existing in the far past, but they say they have been suppressed. Recently in the USA, Nationwide Network went to a museum in California where they have artifacts stored in which archaeologists are saying these are human artifacts which show that intelligent human beings existed in the far distant past. So the Nationwide Network went to film these artifacts and the museum refused. Can't come in. So the public is finding out about these things. And what about life on other planets? The news is out. A former astronaut. In the USA, if you're an astronaut, you're like, you know, what? What's his name? Steve Warner? No. Who's that? The cricket hero.
Steve Wall,
yeah. So, that's the equivalent of an American astronaut. or in India, what's his name? Sachin. Yeah. Equivalent of an astronaut. So, Edgar Mitchell. He's an astronaut. To be an astronaut in the USA, you have to be trained as a scientist, and you have to have the physique of an athlete, Superman. So, this astronaut, he's got a PhD in space science from MIT. He's no slouch. PhD in space science from MIT. and he's got honorary PhDs from 10 other universities. He has all the highest American military medals. And he is going around saying that he knows for a fact that there's truth to UFOs and there's truth to contact with aliens and the U.S. government is hiding. Now what are you going to say? He's a crackpot. He's decorated with all the military medals, academic qualifications, PhD from MIT, 10 other honorary PhDs, and he's saying, I know for a fact they're hiding the information they're afraid to tell the public. What are you going to do? What can you say? So this is getting out now. And he's claiming that the American military is taking crashed UFOs and back engineering the innovations on them and using them. So many of these things are happening. I try to make people aware of the whole broad picture of the earthquake in knowledge that's hitting us right now. Many people aren't aware of the whole gamut. They know one thing, yeah, consciousness is a mystery. Or, yeah, extraterrestrial life, that's a mystery. Or, yeah, human antiquity, that's a mystery. But to put the whole thing together is quite shocking. My point is that if you turn to the ancient Vedic texts of India, you will be in good shape for handling all these shocks. Because the ancient Vedic texts like Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam deal with the mystery of consciousness, how we are non-material, how we have a non-material identity. The ancient Vedic knowledge deals with the mystery of life on other planets. It deals with going to other planets using psychic powers, mystic powers. It deals with intelligent human beings existing on the Earth planet far earlier than what our conventional knowledge tells us. Therefore, we're recommending acquaintance with the Vedic knowledge of India as a means to be on the cutting edge. Somebody from India don't even know the potential glories of India's past. My spiritual teacher, the founder of the Hare Krishna Worldwide Organization, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, he was speaking at MIT to about 400 students, explaining to them the Krishna conscious knowledge contained in Bhagavad Gita and other Vedic texts. And after he spoke, there was time for questions. And there were some Indian students in the audience, of course. And one raised his hand and said, Swamiji, why have you come all the way here to teach this traditional Indian knowledge that our grandmother would teach us? This knowledge has not done India, it hasn't done India any good. What India needs is technology. Why are you coming all the way to MIT, bringing this here? So, Srila Prabhupada answered them, saying, you have come here to beg. You come here to beg technology. I have come to give. To give the highest knowledge that can fill in the holes of these great gaps in Western knowledge. Western knowledge is great for dealing with quantification, things you can measure. But it's horrible in dealing with qualification, qualia, perceptions, and what is perceiving. And it's very notoriously bad in dealing with grasping situations, existence as a whole. But it's very good in chopping things apart, analyzing little bits, but not being able to put together a coherent picture. So much so that when scientists talk about universal laws of nature, unified field theory, they always take into account matter, but they can't bring consciousness into it. So where in universal law? How can that be? Intelligent persons are concerned with these points. According to what I think I am, matter or something else, that's how I live my life. Outside you hear the sounds of Friday night. Those sounds mean. How can we stimulate our gross bodies and our subtle astral psychic bodies? A real civilization will present people with the means to explore their spiritual identity, to explore the mystery of consciousness. So what I try to do in speaking around the world is to alert people to the various possibilities. What's going on? Even from mainstream sources. For example, recently, I don't know if you're aware, a professor of psychiatry at Harvard University, John Mack, not only professor of psychiatry at Harvard University, but also Pulitzer Prize winner, America's top literary prize. He heard so much about persons claiming to have been visited by extraterrestrials, alien encounters. He thought it was all a bunch of bunk. As a professor, as a scientifically minded person, he thought, let me investigate. It'll be easy for me to show this is all illusion. So he made a thorough study as in his laboratory as professor of psychiatry at Harvard University. When he finished his study, he changed his tune completely. He said, I have to admit there is truth to what these people are saying. They actually have had alien encounters. Now what are you going to say? Oh, he must be a crackpot. You can't say he's a crackpot because you look at his qualifications. What you find is that people know a few things like this, but most people haven't put the whole picture together. They feel the ground rumbling underneath them in terms of the conventional foundations of Western knowledge. But once they see the whole gamut of extraordinary challenges to Western knowledge, then they understand what we're in store for. What Western knowledge has to cope with is, what is the self? Are we matter or are we something else? Also, Western knowledge has to cope with the true history of humanity on this planet. Why has there been suppressed archaeological knowledge about human antiquity going back far into the past, far further than what is conventionally allowed? Then, what about the notion that only Earth, only this planet Earth, has intelligent life? That notion is also under attack.
also force a major change in our religious outlook. Many scholars of religion have already said our present religions are not going to be able to hold up if the truth about life on other planets gets out. Let's just say this Edgar Mitchell, this astronaut, PhD in space science, aeronautics from MIT and a host of other honorary PhDs. Let's say he's telling me the truth and say, means I know for a fact the government's withholding this information. I know, I have contacts in the military. They say the government's afraid that this information gets out, the people are not ready for it. So let's say it's true. Then we can just imagine what religious scholars, what they're saying, and we can imagine it coming into being. They're saying, if indeed that is true, that there is life on other planets, our current religion, as we know it, will not be able to hold up. Our current religions, Western religions, are all earth-based, very geocentric. Vedic knowledge, however, is not geocentric. The ancient Vedic knowledge of India has a cosmic outlook in which Earth is just considered one of innumerable planets with life on it. And the ancient Vedic knowledge of India takes for granted that it's possible to travel from one planet to another if you have the appropriate psychic skills. So just think about that. How is it that the Western religions, born of the Middle East, how can they cope with the salvation of peoples of other planets? The ancient Vedic knowledge of India has no problem with that. But these are things that are going on. And an intelligent person should be very curious about these things, because they're going to be shaping life in this century. They bowled up at the end of the 20th century, and now these things are really coming into fruition. Another example. There's a medical researcher named Stevenson who accumulates evidence that reincarnation is a fact based on interviewing children who remember their past life and then sending academic researchers to the place where these children said they lived in their previous life and corroborating the story of the children. At the University of Virginia, he's compiled volume after volume of accounts of this. Such and such a five-year-old child says, in my past life I was this and that, and I was killed in an accident, or someone killed me, or so then the scientists send some researchers to where that child says he or she was from, and they find indeed such a person existed. Okay, one time flew, two times flew. He said he didn't have enough researchers to cope with all the evidence. So he just published as much as he can in thick volumes. The evidence is so compelling that the AMA, the American Medical Association, the very powerful organization of doctors in the USA, they said, what can we say? We can't refute his evidence. Something to think about. This is what's going on. My point is that by studying the ancient Vedic knowledge of India, you'll be in the best position for coping with all these new trends. Near-death experiences, reincarnation knowledge, psychic powers, life on other planets, aliens, alien encounters, lost antiquity of the human species, knowledge of consciousness. These are the things that are going to be shaping the next decades in this century. Just one of them is enough to sink the current paradigms of Western knowledge. Just one of them. If it's so that there's life on other planets, if it's so that reincarnation can be proved reasonable. Any one of these things. If it is so that intelligent human beings existed far earlier than what the current story of human antiquity allows for. Any one of these things will overturn our version of human existence. You won't be just going from Windows 3.1 to Windows 95. You'll be into a whole different game. Things are going to change quite a bit. So our point is that by taking the ancient Vedic knowledge of India seriously, you will be in the best position to deal with all these things. Most importantly, we have to cope with the issue. Am I this body? Am I matter? Or am I something else? Because according to what I think I am, that will determine how I try to satisfy myself in life. If I am matter, then yeah, I should just try to stimulate myself as if I'm a hunk of matter. But if I'm spirit, then I should satisfy myself in another way. Any questions at this point? What did Buddha teach precisely? He said, I've come to teach two things and two things only. What is misery, the Sanskrit word, dukkha, and how to become free from misery, dukkha. Okay, now what do you do after you become free from misery? Then what? That's another level. Let's say you've been banging your head against the wall all your life, and someone convinces you to stop. Certainly you'll feel relief, but then what do you do with your head now that you stop banging your head against the wall? In other words, once we find out what we're not, once we get out of the matrix of illusion, then what do? That's the most confidential spiritual knowledge. The knowledge of activity on the spiritual plane. What Buddha taught is a subset of the full knowledge that you need. It's good to know what you're not. It's good to know what is the illusion, but then you have to find out what is real. The Sanskrit word nirvana means out of the forest. Vana means forest, nir means out. So when you're out of the forest of illusion, where are you? Buddha didn't teach that. You didn't go that far. If people are causing a disturbance, it is a great improvement to just get them to sit down and be quiet. But sooner or later, the question is going to be there. What can they positively do? and who is the positive doer. Once you get rid of the false ego, what is the real ego? So Bhakti Yoga deals with that, the real ego.
I was wondering if you could say something a little more about, you talked about consciousness in terms of quality. You talked about...
You see, Vedic knowledge is state specific. That means according to the quality of your consciousness, you can understand certain things. Western knowledge does not accept this point, or doesn't deal with this point. According to Western knowledge, your personal behavior has no effect on your capacity to understand. It has no effect upon your intelligence. But Vedic knowledge doesn't accept this point. Vedic knowledge teaches that according to your level of consciousness, or the purity of your consciousness, quality of your consciousness, that determines what you can perceive. Who you are determines what you see. Therefore, those who take the trouble to refine their consciousness and distill their consciousness see reality differently. What Bhakti Yoga does is retrain your senses for perceiving reality in a full way. So you're not so matter-bound. It takes some time. One physicist at Harvard said that for students who are trying to master quantum mechanics, it takes on the average 8 years to teach them how to perceive the strange world of quantum physics because it's so different from what their senses are ordinarily accustomed to perceive. 8 years to perceive in a different way, so quantum mechanics makes sense to you. Anyone here studying quantum mechanics? Oh, they don't do that here. Except for the other university. We have to think, if I don't know what is consciousness, how do I know truly what I'm aware of? If I don't know the very thing that's allowing me to have awareness. Bhakti Yoga, or Krishna consciousness, allows you to fully understand what is consciousness and how consciousness can be polluted or purified, and what are the results of purification or pollution. So I think you all will have an exciting time exploring these subject matters. I don't think you should feel that in any way you're pursuing some oddity. In fact, no, you're on the cutting edge. And the coming decades are going to require persons like you who can help people bridge the enormous gulf between traditional Western knowledge and all these things that are becoming known now. For example, already the Catholic Church, the Vatican, has a Monsignor starting to address the people about, okay, so what if there's life on other planets? Doesn't mean the end of religion as we're presenting it to. In other words, there's concern. This thing is Monsignor Balducci. He goes on television in Europe. He's already working the crowd, so to speak. So, well, it could be that these things are true, but it doesn't mean the end of Catholicism. He's an official Vatican representative. Well, religious scholars say otherwise. They say, if this extraterrestrial thing hits, if the U.S. government actually uncovers what it's supposed to have, it will mean the end of religion as people know it. But for those who are adepts in the Vedic knowledge of ancient India, it'll be just kid stuff. And what about ancient civilizations popping out of nowhere, such as just happened in Central Asia? Ancient civilizations, at least 4,000 years old, with apartment complexes as big as football fields. From the Vedic point of view, these things are not wonders. So I'm just trying to give you an introduction tonight of the possibilities. And I'm also trying to encourage you in your responsibility for helping to ferry people across this huge gulf that's going to become more and more apparent. You'll find in Bhagavad Gita that Krishna explains that consciousness is the energy of the non-material self, known as the soul. Consciousness cannot be proved to come from matter. Science is divided into three camps now about consciousness. You have the hardcore materialists who say, without a doubt, consciousness is just matter, or it's just something that emanates from matter. There's no proof, but they just have that dogma, that belief, that religious belief. Then on the other side, there are those who say, the scientists who say, consciousness can never be understood in terms of matter. And then you have those in the middle who say, we just don't know, and maybe we'll never know. So those are the three camps right now. Vedic knowledge doesn't have a problem with the mystery of consciousness. You see, the fact that consciousness is so difficult for Western knowledge to understand should lead you to think that, well then, perhaps the reason why consciousness is so inamenable to analysis is because it's leading you to a spiritual reality. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains, Avinashi Chitta-Vidhi. You should know that that which pervades the whole body is consciousness, and consciousness is the energy of the soul. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna also explains that according to your consciousness at the time of death, you get another body. Your physical body matches your consciousness. So if you have a particular kind of consciousness at the time of death that doesn't merit a human body, you don't get a human body in your next life. The Vedic viewpoint holds that all species of life have some degree of consciousness, not just humans. Animals are conscious, plants are conscious, trees are conscious, insects are conscious. It's just that their type of body does not permit the maximum display of consciousness that a human body does. Yes. And I can make it. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains that the highest yogi is the one who connects to the Supreme in transcendental loving devotion. Such a yogi is far beyond those who are pursuing psychic powers, mystic powers. We are parts of something. Now, what is the reality that we are part of? The knowledge we desperately need is, what is the whole that I am part of? How can we be holistic without knowing the complete whole of which we are a small part? Everyone likes that word, holistic, but no one knows what is the complete whole that all of existence is a part of. Bhakti yoga deals with that kind of understanding. What is your relationship between you as spirit soul and Krishna as the Supreme Soul? And how should you act in that relationship? The relationship between you as individual consciousness and the relationship with the Supreme Consciousness. These are exciting topics. We don't expect massive amounts of persons to be interested at this point. But we fully understand that gradually the tremors will be felt throughout all the departments of the university as the paradigm shift becomes more and more obvious.
Anything else? I was just wondering, according to science, the universe is constantly expanding. Does the Vedic science of India explain anything about this?
Yes, the Vedic science of Srimad Bhagavatam presents inflationary universes.
Is it that just that inflation keeps on going on, or is it that at some point in time it will come to an end?
Yes. Anything that is matter has a beginning and an end. Although the basic material energy is conserved even after the annihilation of the cosmos. So the Vedic knowledge agrees that energy can neither be created nor destroyed. But what is the source of all the energy that can't be created or destroyed? That is the mystery. The source of the energy is more important than the energy. So we have to get knowledge of the Supreme Source.
But that mystery has not been mentioned in the time here.
Which mystery?
The source.
Of course.
Yes.
Definitely.
And wasn't that the source?
The source of everything is conscious. Supreme conscious person who has an impersonal manifestation which is subordinate. The ultimate source of everything is a conscious entity. Animals, trees, insects have consciousness. Without consciousness, how can you be aware of anything? You can't be the Supreme, but you can be a harmonious part of the Supreme.
You never thought you were the Supreme, did you? Your job is to find out how you can be a cooperative part of the Supreme. That is the yoga Krishna consciousness. Just like you're in Australia now, so you want to know, what are the laws here? How can you be a proper resident of this country? Being in Australia is just a tiny part of your total reality. What is the actual total reality? And how are we meant to be a part of it? This is Bhakti Yoga. What is the nature of the total reality? What is the nature of the Supreme Source of everything? The Supreme Source of everything has to be conscious because you are conscious. But Krishna has unlimited consciousness. You only have a tiny bit of consciousness. All right. So thank you very much for your attention. I hope you have a good time exploring themes like this throughout the coming year at this club. All right.